Side 9, The Tommyknockers, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 243.
What? What? What does that?
It means he's gone too far,
the Kachina doll said, and suddenly green light seemed to sweat out of its cottonwood pores. As she looked at it, numb with terror, its wooden face split open in a sinister yawning grin. A dead cricket fell out of it and struck the floor with a dry desert click.
Gone too far, too far, too far.
No, I don't believe that, Ruth screamed.
The whole town, Ruth, gone too far, too far, too far.
No,
lost.
The eyes of the Griner papier-mâché doll suddenly filled with that liquid green fire.
You're lost too,
it said.
You're just as crazy as the rest now. David Brown's just an excuse to stay here.
No.
But all of her dolls were stirring now, that green fire moving from one to the other until her schoolroom flared with that light. It was waxing and waning, and she thought with sick horror that it was like being inside some ghastly emerald heart. They stared at her with their glazy eyes, and at last she understood why the dolls had frightened Edwina Thurlow so badly. Now it was the voices of her dolls rising in that autumn leafy swirl, whispering slyly, rattling among themselves, rattling to her. But these were the voices of the town, too, and Ruth McCausland knew it. She thought they were perhaps the last of the town's sanity, and of her own.
Something has to be done, Ruth.
It was the China Bisque doll, fire dripping from its mouth. It was the voice of Beach Jernigan.
Have to warn someone.
It was the French coupé, with its rubbery gutta-percha body. It was the voice of Hazel McCready.
But they'll never let you out now, Ruth.
It was the Nixon doll, his stuffed fingers raised in twin V's, speaking in the voice of John Enders down at the grammar school.
They could, but that would be wrong.
They love you, Ruth, but if you try to leave now, they'll kill you. You know that, don't you?
Her 1910 Cupid doll with its rubber head like an inverted teardrop. This voice was Justin Hurd's.
Have to send a signal.
Signal, Ruth. Yes, and you know how. Use us. We can show you how. We know.
She took a shambling step backward, her hands going to her ears as if she could shut out the voices that way. Her mouth twisted. She was terrified, and what frightened her most was how she ever could have mistaken these voices with their twisted truths for sanity. All of Haven's concentrated madness was here right now.
Signal. Use us, we can show you how. We know, and you want to know, the town hall roof, the clock tower.
The rustling voices took up a chant.
The town hall roof, yes, yes, that's it. The town hall, yes.
Stop it, she screamed. Stop it, oh please, won't you?
And then, for the first time since she was 11 and had passed out after winning the girls' mile race at the Methodist summer picnic, Ruth McCausland fainted dead away. 6. Sometime early during the night, she regained a soupy version of consciousness and stumbled downstairs to her bedroom without looking back. She was, in fact, afraid to look back. She was dully aware that her head was throbbing, as it had on the few occasions when she had drunk too much and awakened with a hangover. She was also aware that the old Victorian house was rocking and creaking like an old schooner in heavy weather. While Ruth had lain senseless on the schoolroom floor, terrible thunderstorms racked central and eastern Maine. A cold front from the Midwest had finally bowled its way into New England, pushing out the still sink of heat and humidity that had covered the area for the last week and a half. The change in the weather was accompanied by terrible thunderstorms in some places. Haven was spared the worst of these, but the power was out again, and would remain so for several days this time. But the fact that the power outage wasn't the important thing. Haven had its own unique power sources now. The important thing was simply that the weather had changed. When that happened, Ruth wasn't the only person in Haven to wake up with a horrible hangover sort of headache. Everyone in town, from the oldest to the youngest, woke up feeling the same way as the strong winds blew the tainted air east, sending it out over the ocean, fragmenting it into harmless tatters. 7. Ruth slept until 1 o'clock Wednesday afternoon. She got up with the lingering remains of her headache, but Two Aniston took care of that. By 5, she felt better than she had for a long time. Her body ached, and her muscles were stiff, but these were minor matters compared with the things that had troubled her since the beginning of July, and they could not cut into her sense of well-being at all. Even her fear for David Brown couldn't spoil it completely. On Main Street, everyone she passed had a peculiar dazed look in his or her eye, as though they had all just awakened from a spell cast by a fairy tale witch. Ruth went to her office in the town hall, enjoying the way the wind lifted her hair from her temples, the way the clouds moved across a sky that was a deep, crisp blue, a sky that looked almost autumnal. She saw a couple of kids flying a box kite in the big field behind the grammar school and actually laughed aloud. But there was no laughing later, as she spoke to a small group she quickly gathered, Haven's 3 selectmen, the town manager, and of course Bryant and Marie Brown. Ruth began by apologizing for not having called the state police and wardens before now, or even reporting the boy's disappearance. She had believed, she said, that they would find David quickly, probably the first night, certainly the next day. She knew that was no excuse, but it was why she had allowed it to happen. It had been, she said, the worst mistake she had made in her years as Haven's constable, and if David Brown had suffered for it, she would never forgive herself. Bryant just nodded, dazed and distant and ill-looking. Marie, however, reached across the table and took her hand. "You're not to blame yourself," she said softly. "There were other circumstances. We all know that." The others nodded.
"I can't hear their minds anymore,"
Ruth realized suddenly, and her mind responded,
"Could you ever, Ruth? Really? Or was that a hallucination brought on by your worry over David Brown?" "Yes. Yes, I could."
It would be easier to believe it had been a hallucination, but that wasn't the truth. And realizing that, she realized something else. She could still do it. It was like hearing a faint roaring sound in a conch shell, that sound children mistake for the ocean. She had no idea what their thoughts were, but she was still hearing them. Were they hearing her?
"Are you still there?"
she shouted as loudly as she could. Marie Brown's hand went to her temple, as if she had felt a sudden stab of pain. Newt Berenger frowned deeply. Hazel McCready, who had been doodling on the pad in front of her, looked up as if Ruth had spoken aloud.
"Oh, yes. They still hear me."
"Whatever happened, right or wrong, is done now," Ruth said. "It's time, and over time, that I contacted the state police about David. Do I have your approval to take this step?" Under normal circumstances, it never would have crossed her mind that she should ask them a question like that. After all, they paid her pittance of a salary to answer questions, not to ask them. But things were different in Haven now. Fresh breeze and clear air or not, things were still different in Haven now. They looked at her, surprised and a little shocked. Now the voices came back to her clearly.
"No, Ruth. No. No outsiders. We'll take care. We don't need any outsiders while we become. Shh, for your life, Ruth. Shh."
Outside, the wind blew a particularly hard gust, rattling the windows of Ruth's office. Adley McKean looked toward the sound. They all did. Then Adley smiled a puzzled, peculiar little smile.
"Of course, Ruth," he said. "If you think it's time to notify the Stadies, you got to go ahead. We trust your judgment, don't we?"
The others agreed. The weather had changed. The wind was blowing, and by Wednesday afternoon, the state police were in charge of the search for David Brown. 8. By Friday, Ruth McCausland understood that Wednesday and Thursday had been an untrustworthy respite in an ongoing process. She was being driven steadily toward some alien madness. A dim part of her mind recognized the fact, bemoaned it, but was unable to stop it. It could only hope that the voices of her dolls held some truth, as well as madness. Watching as if from outside herself, she saw her hands take her sharpest kitchen knife, the one she used for boning fish, from the drawer. She took it upstairs into the schoolroom. The schoolroom glowed, rotten with green lights. Tommyknocker lights. That was what everyone in town was calling them now, and it was a good name, wasn't it? Yes. As good as any. The Tommyknockers.
Send a signal. That's all you can do now. They want to get rid of you, Ruth. They love you, but their love has turned homicidal. I suppose you can find a twisted sort of respect in that, because they're still afraid of you. Even now, now when you're almost as nutty as the rest of them, they're afraid of you. Maybe someone will hear the signal. Hear it. See it. Understand it.
9. Now there was a shaky drawing of the town hall clock tower on her board, the scrawled work of a first grader. Ruth could not stand to work on the dolls in the schoolroom, not in that terrible light that waxed and pulsed. She took them, one by one, into her husband's study and slit their bellies open like a surgeon. The French Madame, the 19th-century clown, the QP, all of them, one by one. And into each she put a small gadget made of C-cells, wires, electronic calculator circuit boards, and the cardboard cores from toilet paper rolls. She sewed the incisions up quickly, using a coarse black thread. As the line of naked dolls grew longer on her husband's desk, they began to look like dead children, victims of some grisly mass poisoning, perhaps, who had been stripped and robbed after death. Each sewn incision parted in the middle so that one of the toilet paper rolls could poke out like the barrel of some odd telescope. Only cardboard. The rolls would still serve to channel the force when it was generated. She didn't know how she knew this, or how she had known to build the gadgets in the first place. The knowledge seemed to have come shimmering out of the air. The same air into which David Brown
is on Altair 4
had disappeared. As she plunged the knife into their plump, defenseless bellies, green light puffed out. I'm
sending a signal. Murdering the only children I ever had.
The signal. Think of the signal, not the children. She used extension cords to wire the dolls neatly together in a chain. She had stripped the insulation from the last 4 inches of these cords and slipped the gleaming copper into an M16 firecracker she had confiscated from Beach Jernigan's 14-year-old son, Hump. Thus known because one shoulder rolled slightly higher than the other, about a week before all this madness began. She looked back, doubtful for a moment, into her schoolroom with its empty benches. Enough light fell through the archway for her to be able to see the drawing of the town hall clock tower. She had done it in one of those blank periods that seemed to be getting longer and longer. The hands of the clock in the drawing were set at 3. Ruth set her work aside and went to bed. She slept, but her sleep was not easy. She twisted and turned and moaned. Even in her sleep, the voices ran through her head, thoughts of revenge planned, of cakes to be baked, sexual fantasies, worries about irregularity, ideas for strange gadgets and machines, dreams of power. And below them all, a thin, irrational yammer like a polluted stream, thoughts coming from the heads of her fellow townspeople, but not human thoughts. And in her nightmarish sleep, that part of Ruth McCausland which clung stubbornly to sanity knew the truth. These were not the rising voices of the people she had lived with all these years, but those of outsiders. They were the voices of the Tommyknockers. 10. Ruth understood by Thursday noon that the change in the weather hadn't solved anything. The state police came, but they did not institute a widespread search. Ruth's report, detailed and complete as always, made it clear that David Brown, 4, could hardly have wandered outside their search area unless he'd been abducted, a possibility they would now have to consider. Her report was accompanied by topographical maps. These were annotated in her careful, no-nonsense handwriting and made it clear she had conducted the search thoroughly.
"Careful and thorough you were, Ruthie,"
Monster Dugan told her that evening. His brow was furrowed in a frown so huge each line looked like an earthquake fissure.
"You always have been, but I never knew you to pull a John Wayne stunt like this before."
"Butch, I'm sorry."
"Yeah. Well,"
he shrugged.
"Done is done, huh?"
"Yes," she said and smiled wanly. It had been one of Ralph's favorite sayings. Butch asked a lot of questions, but not the one she needed to answer. Ruth, what's wrong in Haven? The high winds had cleansed the town's atmosphere. None of the outsiders sensed anything was wrong. But the winds hadn't ended the trouble. The bad magic was still going on. Whatever it was, it seemed to continue by itself after a certain point. Ruth guessed that point had been reached. She wondered what a team of doctors conducting mass physicals in Haven might find. Iron shortages in the women? Men with suddenly receding hairlines? Improved visual acuity? Especially peripheral vision, matched by a surprisingly high loss of teeth? People who seemed so bright they were spooky, so in tune with you they almost seemed to be, reading your mind? Ruth herself had lost two more teeth Wednesday night. One she found on her pillow Thursday morning, a grotesquely middle-aged offering to the tooth fairy. The other was nowhere to be found. She supposed she had swallowed them. Not that it mattered. 11. The compulsion to blow up the town hall became maddening mental poison ivy, itching at her brain all the time. The doll voices whispered and whispered. On Friday, she made a final effort to save herself. She decided to leave town, after all. It was not hers anymore. She guessed that staying even this long had been one of the traps that Tommyknockers had laid for her. And, like the David Brown trap, she had blundered into it, as confused as a rabbit in a snare. She thought her old dodge wouldn't start. They would have fixed it. But it did. Then she thought she would not be allowed out of Haven Village, that they would stop her, smiling like moonies and sending their endless, rustly,
"We all love you, Ruth,"
thoughts. She wasn't. She rolled down Main Street and out into the country, Ruth sitting bolt upright and white-knuckled, a graven smile on her face, tongue twisters,
"She sells pickled peppers, bitter butter,"
flying through her head. She felt her gaze being pulled toward the town hall clock tower.
"A signal, Ruth, send. Yes, the explosion, the lovely. Bang. Blow it all the way to Eltair 4, Ruth."
And resisted with all her might. This compulsion to blow up the town hall, to call attention to what was going on here, was insane. It was like setting your house on fire to roast a chicken. She felt better when the brick tower was out of sight. Once on Derry Road, she had to resist an urge to get the dart moving as fast as it would go, which, considering its years, was still surprisingly fast. She felt like a lucky escapee from a den of lions, one who has escaped more by good luck than good sense. As the village dropped behind and those rustling voices fell away, she began to feel that someone must be giving belated chase. She glanced again and again into the rearview mirror, expecting to see vehicles chasing after her, wanting to bring her back. They would insist that she come back. They loved her too much to let her go. But the road had remained clear. No Dick Allison screaming after her in one of the town's three fire engines. No Newt Beringer in his big old mint-green Olds 88. No Bobby Tremaine in his yellow Challenger. As she approached the Haven Albion town line, she put the dart up to 50, the closer she got to the town line, which she had begun to think of, rightly or not, as the point at which her escape would become irrevocable, the more she found the last 2 weeks seeming like some black, twisted nightmare.
"Can't go back. Can't."
Her foot on the dart's accelerator pedal kept growing heavier. At the end, something warned her. Perhaps it was something the voices had said and her subconscious had filed away. She was, after all, receiving all sorts of information now, in her sleep as well as when she was awake. As the town line marker came up, Albion, her foot left the dart's gas pedal and stepped on the brake. It went down mushily and much too far, as it had for the last 4 years or so. Ruth allowed the car to roll off the tar and onto the shoulder, dust as white and dry as bone meal plumed up behind her. The wind had died. The air of Haven was deadly still again. The dust she had raised, Ruth thought, would hang for a long time. She sat with her hands curled tightly on the wheel, wondering why she had stopped. Wondering. Almost knowing. Beginning.
To become.
To know. Or guess.
A barrier? Is that what you think, that they've put up a barrier? That they've managed to turn all of Haven into an ant farm or something under a bowl? Phew, that's ridiculous.
And so it was. Not only according to logic and experience, but also according to the evidence of her senses. As she sat behind the wheel, listening to the radio, soft jazz which was coming from a low-power college station in Bergenfield, New Jersey, a Hillcrest chicken truck, probably bound for dairy, rumbled past her. A few seconds later, a Chevy Vega went by in the other direction. Nancy Voss was behind the wheel. The sticker on the rear bumper read, "Postal workers do it by express mail." Nancy Voss did not look at Ruth, simply went along her way, which in this case probably meant Augusta.
"See? Nothing stopping them,"
Ruth thought.
"No,"
her mind whispered back.
"Not them, Ruth, just you. It would stop you, and it would stop Bobby Anderson's friend. Maybe one or two others. Go on. Drive right into it at 50 miles an hour or so if you don't believe it. We all love you, and we would hate to see it happen to you. But we wouldn't, couldn't, stop it from happening."
Instead of driving, she got out and walked up to the Haven Albion line. Her shadow trailed long behind her. The hot July sun beat down on her head. She could hear the dim but steady rumble of machinery from the woods behind Bobby's place. Digging again. The David Brown vacation was over, and she sensed that they were getting close to, well, to something. This brought a sense of panic and urgency. She approached the marker, passed it, kept walking, and began to feel a wild rising hope. She was out of Haven. She was in Albion. In a moment she would run screaming to the nearest house, the nearest telephone. She slowed. A puzzled look settled upon her face, and then deepened into a dawning, horrified certainty. It was getting hard to walk. The air was becoming tough, springy. She could feel it stretching her cheeks, the skin of her forehead. She could feel it flattening her breasts. Ruth lowered her head and continued to walk, her mouth drawn down in a grimace of effort, cords standing out on her neck. She looked like a woman trying to walk into a gale-force wind, although the trees on either side of the road were barely swaying their leaves. The image which came to her now, and the one which had come to Gardner when he tried to reach into the bottom of Anderson's customized water heater, were exactly the same. They differed only in degree. Ruth felt as if the entire road had been blocked by an invisible nylon stocking, one large enough to fit a female titan.
"I've heard about nude-look hose,"
she thought hysterically.
"But really, this is ridiculous."
Her breasts began to ache from the pressure, and suddenly her feet began to slip in the dirt. Panic slapped at her. She had reached, then passed the point where her ability to generate forward motion surpassed the elastic give of the invisible barrier. Now it was shoving her back out. She struggled to turn, to get out on her own before that could happen, but she lost her footing and was snapped rudely back the way she had come, her feet scraping, her eyes wide and shocked. It was like being pushed by the expanding side of a large rubbery balloon. For a moment, her feet left the ground entirely. Then she landed on her knees, scraping them both badly, tearing her dress. She got up and back toward her car, crying a little with the pain. She sat behind the wheel of her car for almost 20 minutes, waiting for the throbbing in her knees to subside. Cars and trucks passed occasionally along Derry Road in both directions, and once, as she sat there, Ashley Raval came along on his bike. He had his fishing pole. He saw her and raised a hand to her.
"Hi, Mrs. McCaughlin,"
he cried chirpily and grinned. The lisp wasn't really surprising, she thought dully, considering that all of the boy's teeth were gone. Not some. All. Still, she felt coldness rush through her as Ashley called, "We all love you, Mrs. McCaughlin." After a long time, she backed the dart up, U-turned, and went back through the hot silence to Haven Village. As she drove up Main Street to her house, it seemed that a great many people looked at her, their eyes full of a knowledge more sly than wise. Ruth looked up into the dart's rearview mirror and saw the clock tower at the other end of the village's short Main Street. The hands were approaching 3 p.m. She pulled to a stop in front of the Fannin, bumping carelessly up over the curb and stalling the engine. She didn't bother to turn off the key. She only sat behind the wheel, red idiot lights glowing on the instrument panel, looking into the rearview mirror as her mind floated gently away. When she came back to herself, the town hall clock was chiming 6. She had lost 3 hours. And another tooth. The hours were nowhere to be found, but the tooth, an incisor, lay on the lap of her dress. 12. All that night her dolls talked to her, and she thought that none of what they said was precisely a lie. That was the most horrible thing of all. She sat in the green, diseased heart of their influence and listened to them tell their lunatic fairy tales. They told her she was right to believe she was going crazy. An X-ray of her brain, they said, one of anyone in Haven for that matter, would make a neurologist run screaming for cover. Her brain was changing. It was becoming. Her brain, her teeth, oh, excuse me, make that X-teeth, both becoming. And her eyes, they were changing color, weren't they? Yes. Their deep brown was fading toward hazel, and the other day in the Haven lunch, hadn't she noticed that Beach Jernigan's bright blue eyes were also changing color? Deepening toward Hazel.
Hazel eye. No teeth. Oh, dear God, what's happening to us?
The dolls looked at her glassily and smiled.
Don't worry, Ruth. It's only the invasion from space they've made cheap movies about for years. You see that, don't you? The invasion of the Tommyknockers. If you want to see the invaders from space, the B-movies and the science fiction stories were always going on about, look in Beach Jernigan's eyes, or Wendy's, or your own.
What you mean is that I'm being eaten up, she whispered in the summer darkness, as Friday night became Saturday morning.
Why, Ruth, what did you think becoming was?
The dolls laughed. And Ruth's mind mercifully floated away once again. 13. When she woke on Saturday morning, the sun was up. The shaky child's drawing of the town hall clock tower was on the schoolroom blackboard, and there were better than 24 calculators on Ralph's sheeted study desk. They were in the canvas shoulder bag she used when she went out collecting for the Cancer Society. There were dymotapes on some of the calculators. Beringer, McCready, Selectman's Office Do Not Remove, Department of Taxes. She hadn't gone to sleep after all. Instead, she had drifted into one of those blank periods and looted all the town office's calculators, it looked like.
Why? Yours not to reason why, Ruth,
the dolls whispered. And she understood better and better each day, better and better each minute, each second, in fact, what had frightened little Edwina Thurlow so badly.
Yours is but to send a signal and die.
How much of that idea is mine, and how much is them driving me?
Doesn't matter, Ruth. It's going to happen anyway, so make it happen as fast and hard and soon as you can. Stop thinking. Let it happen. Because part of you wants it to happen, doesn't it?
Yes. Most of her, in fact. And not to send a signal to the outside world or any silly bullshit like that. That was just the thin icing on a rich devil's food cake of irrationality. She wanted to be a part of it as it all went up. The cardboard tubes would channel the force, send it up into the clock tower in a bright river of destructive power, and the tower would lift off like a rocket. The shockwave would hammer the street of this fouled haven with destruction, and destruction was what she wanted. That want was part of her becoming. 14. That night, Butch Dugan called her to update her on the David Brown case. Some of the developments were unusual. The boy's brother, Hillman, was in the hospital, in a state which closely resembled catatonia. The kid's grandfather wasn't much better. He had begun telling people that David Brown hadn't just gotten lost, but had actually disappeared. That the magic trick, in other words, had been real. And, Butch said, he was telling anyone who would listen that half the people in Haven were going crazy and the rest were already there.
He went up to Bangor and talked to a fellow named Bright on the news,
Monster said.
They wanted human interest and got nut stuff instead. Old man's turning into a real quasar, Ruth.
Better tell him to stay away, Ruth said. They'll let him in, but he'll never get out again.
What?
Monster shouted. His voice was suddenly becoming faint.
This connection's going to hell, Ruth. I said there may be something new tomorrow. I still haven't given up hope.
She rubbed her temples steadily and looked at the dolls in a row on Ralph's desk and wired up like a terrorist's bomb. Look for a signal tomorrow.
What?
Monster's voice was almost lost in the rising surf of the worsening connection.
Goodbye, Butch. You're a hell of a sport.
Listen for it. You'll hear it all the way up in Derry, I think. 3 on the nose.
Ruth, I'm losing you. Call back. Soon.
She hung up the useless telephone, looked at her dolls, listened to the rising voices, and waited for it to be time.